Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Matty Wilkes. Matty is a postdoctoral researcher at Yale University working with Professor Paul Bloom. She studies moral psychology and moral development, including attitudes to cultivated meat and the natural, the moral status of various types of entities, and investigations into the nature of altruism. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write us a review or give us some stars on your or listening platform? Every share, review, and rating helps us nudge a few more of the 7.7 billion people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups that are open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. The biggest is on Facebook. Thanks for listening. Hi, Matty. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, thanks. Very good. Thanks so much for making the time to join these sentientist conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have a chance to talk to you. I mean, your work is highly relevant to many of the themes of sentientism. And as a reminder, I guess this series of conversations, I'm talking to my guests about what I see as the two deepest philosophical questions: what's real and how should we choose what to believe? And then what matters morally and what should we care about? What should we have compassion for? What do we think matters? And I'm doing that in the context of trying to promote this very simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which, as you're very aware, you know, the term was originally developed and used by people like Richard Rider and Peter Singer and various others in the 1970s, but never really escaped the academic world. And I'm trying to recast it in a modern light as a worldview that, when we ask what's real, says we should take a naturalistic approach. We should use evidence and reason to form provisional and probabilistic beliefs with humility and open-mindedness, really a sort of scientific worldview. And then when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name, that we should focus on sentience as the characteristic that qualifies for moral consideration. So simply speaking, any being that's capable of experiencing flourishing, suffering, we should have compassion for, we should include in our moral calculus, whatever it is. But I'm talking to people who both agree with that sentientist philosophy and disagree with it. So we'll see where the conversation goes. It'll be fascinating to understand your philosophical journey. But before we get to those two questions, how would you best introduce your life and your work for people who don't already know what you do?
So I'm a postdoc at Yale. So I work for Professor Paul Bloom. And I study psychology, specifically looking at moral psychology and moral development. So I'm interested in far too many questions, but some of the things I'm working on at the moment, looking at attitudes to cultured meat, and particularly looking at things like our perception of things that are natural as being bad and natural as being good and unnatural as being bad, and how this affects our willingness to try different food technologies. I do research on the way we think about the moral status of a whole range of different entities, so animals and humans and other life, so artificial life. And I also have a little bit of research, none of which is published yet, which is looking at people who behave in particularly altruistic ways and what's maybe unique about those populations compared to the typical population. So the very common theme in all of my work is morality. And what I guess I'm really interested in understanding is, in these areas that we may not be behaving as ethically or as compassionately as we could be, what are the barriers and what is it that's stopping us from behaving in that way? And so part of it is just my own research interest, but part of it is also I'd like to try and help to make the world a bit better. And if we can do research to understand how to do that, you know, at a bonus. So yeah, that's who I am and what I'm interested in.
That's great. Thank you. And it fits the agenda here perfectly. I love the idea of, yeah, making the world a better place. And us humans are pretty weird. So if you can help us understand that weirdness and why that weirdness gets in the way of us making the world a better place, that's pretty powerful work. So
yeah, well, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, good luck.
But it's a pretty ambitious goal, so.
It is. Let's come to the first of the two questions I like to ask, and that's really what's real. So for many people, that's a story about whether they grew up in a society and a family in a context that was more atheistic and naturalistic and scientifically focused, or it was more traditionally religious, or it's more spiritual. So it'd be really interesting to know your story. And again, you can dial the clock back as far as you like into your childhood and tell us about where you started and whether things have shifted in your worldview now.
Yeah. So I was raised basically without any kind of religious influence. Neither of my parents were religious. And we just didn't really talk about it. It was like, wasn't hidden or anything, but it was just never something that was really on my radar. And so that's been the case my entire life. I know about religions, but I've never really considered, you know, being religious myself or having given it really serious thought. So I've always come from a very scientific and evidence perspective, as well as coming from a background where my parents are vegetarian and we cared a lot about animals and wildlife carers and things like that. So I've had a similar view my entire life, which in some ways is a bit disappointing, right? Because you talk to some people out there who had this amazing epiphany about, like, they wanted to change their religion or change their fundamental views. But I think if anything, my views have probably just gotten stronger or more developed from what was taught to me when I was a child.
Yeah. I mean, if you start out with the right answer, then why change? So.
Well, you said that, not me.
I did. Yeah. And obviously you understand about religions and you've, you know, presumably studied them, and I'm sure know religious people as well. Do you have a particular perspective about religious ways of thinking, or are they just a curious anomaly to you that's never been particularly relevant, or how do you tend to think about it?
I think it's always seemed something that I couldn't understand. Like, my father was Jewish and kind of decided that he wasn't anymore and was quite atheist. And so I guess I've always not been able to understand when people do believe in these kinds of things, but I can see that there's a lot of benefits for people, and I see that it really helps people. It gives them a sense of community and it helps them figure out themselves and their lives. And so I think there's a lot of benefits for people.
Yeah.
It's just not something that I've ever really considered for myself.
Yeah. And for some people, and for many of my guests, as you said, they've had a journey about leaving a religious cultural organization. And for some like me, that was pretty easy and straightforward because I came from a very sort of soft, boring background, sort of Anglican Christianity. And for others, one of my previous guests, John Adeniti, grew up in the evangelist Nigerian Sunday school setup where he was actually one of the Sunday school teachers. And his journey has been much more challenging, as you can imagine. But many of the people I've spoken to have left established religion, and most of them have stayed with a very naturalistic worldview. But some of them have almost revisited the transcendent or the spiritual or the supernatural. They haven't gone back to an established religion, but they still have some sense of being part of something greater, or maybe there's something out there that is still supernatural, or there's a spiritual connection as well. Have you ever been tempted by anything along those lines as well? Or are you much more straight down the line naturalistic?
My father was a very vocal atheist, and I definitely learned a lot from that when I was young, but I definitely went through a period where I was, I guess, not even so much in the belief in supernatural or something greater, but it's the idea that we have a really limited knowledge. So we can only know as much as we know so far, and there's so much out there to learn. And so almost from like a humility perspective, it makes sense that we should be somewhat reserved in our judgments of, you know, larger beliefs. But I never really got further than thinking, there's a very good chance that we don't know everything in the world yet. And so it's entirely plausible. But yeah, that was about the extent of it.
Yeah. And I think that's where I've ended up as well. And that's one of the things these conversations have reminded me really is because I can fall into that trap sometimes of a naturalistic scientific worldview of almost being a bit too confident and a bit too arrogant and a bit too, here are the facts, here are the answers. And these conversations have reminded me that the essence of a naturalistic worldview is having that humility and having that doubt, because if you lose that, you just form a new type of dogma and stop learning and stop improving. And that self-correcting nature is the essence of a naturalistic worldview. So
yes, I completely agree. And I've definitely gone through the very hard line, no, the science, only science. And I very much agree. And I think it's important because, as you said, if we aren't able to be open to learning new things and to new ideas, then we stop growing. So.
Yeah. And the distinction for me is being open-minded and being comfortable not knowing and being comfortable being uncertain and even holding our own beliefs lightly and being ready for new evidence. But being open-minded doesn't mean we ascribe belief to things before the evidence is there. And I think that's the mistake some people make. They're like radically open-minded and then almost arbitrarily choose to believe things that feel good when there is no evidence. Whereas I'm happy to say, well, you might be right, but until the evidence is there, I'm going to hold back from ascribing any meaningful belief to it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction and not something I'd really thought about that explicitly before, but that difference seems really important.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, just for what you were saying before about people who've, like, you know, left very religious households and gone through a lot to leave. I find this incredibly interesting, not necessarily just in the context of religion, but one of the things I'm really interested in studying, and I can talk a little bit about later when we talk about research, is some of my work looks at children who are vegetarian in meat-eating households. And so it's a similar kind of idea, right, where you have never had this social learning about, oh, we shouldn't eat animals, or, you know, eating animals has ethical questions, but some children learn about what happens to animals and they just switch and decide to be vegetarian. And I find it so interesting that there's this like potential to respond differently than most other people respond to the same stimuli without that social learning component. And I think it's relevant to people who grow up in really conservative households and then become quite left-wing in the United States, and people who leave religious families. And I find it the question of what is unique about these people, what actually is the catalyst for that change, to be so interesting. And one of the big things that I really want to answer with my research.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear that you get to talk to people that have actually done that.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it is fascinating, because I think there is a parallel between that story about the moral circle expansion and the story about a religious worldview, because in both situations, the sort of societal default is extremely powerful, often extremely powerful. And some people, as you say, even I've had some guests here who at the age of 5 or 7 or 9 just said, I'm not eating animals anymore. Or they said, I don't believe in God. And I'm like, that's, I think, a reasonably rare but quite amazing capacity for a child that young to go against a very strong social default. Whereas, you know, I think for most people, and I include myself in this, it was a much, much longer journey of, you know, working out who you are and what you think and what you believe and what's right and what's wrong, and somewhat struggling to break free of those defaults a little bit. Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think maybe there's parallels between both of those sides of the story. And in a way, that brings us quite neatly onto the second question that I'd like to talk about here in what matters, because one of the reasons I think some people hold on to a religious worldview, or at least pretend to, sometimes even people who say they're religious don't really believe the supernatural stuff. It's more of a cultural thing or an affinity thing or a community thing. But one of the reasons people are hesitant about letting go is because the supernatural worldview, the religious worldview, gives them some form of moral foundation and some form of moral structure. Now, in my view, it's poorly founded, because the deity they're talking about doesn't exist or is highly unlikely to exist. And the rules and the ethics feel to me much more like something that was dreamt up by a powerful man 2,000 years ago than some egalitarian, compassionate ethics that resonates with the way I think we should live, right? But it is a moral foundation, right? There are rules, there's lists, there's some sort of reassuring structure. And in the extreme, even a supernatural deity that will judge us perfectly from on high and punish us in this life or the next, or reward us in this life or the next. So in a way, it can be quite nerve-wracking for people to leave that behind, because they worry that they'll lose their moral foundations. And I don't think that's valid, and you clearly don't either. My last guest had an amazing conversation where quite a close personal friend said to them, the only reason I'm not going out killing people is because of my belief in God, which I thought was a strange thing for a person to admit. And I don't actually believe they really meant it. But some people think that way. Without the supernatural, we'll be running around killing each other. So it's a long, rambling way of asking the question. But so what do you base your morality on, given you have a naturalistic worldview? And again, it would be interesting to know how that's shifted over time, if it has.
Yeah, this is something I have spent pretty much my whole life thinking about. So like, I feel since I was, as long as I can remember, I've been interested in questions of what's ethical and why do we behave ethically and why don't we? And so I for someone who spent their whole life thinking about it, actually probably should have come further. But I guess, as you assumed, I don't think that it comes from a religious place. And I've actually had a lot of conversations with people who've said, oh, there wouldn't be any morality without religion. And I just, that doesn't make any sense to me. I guess there's like kind of two questions in there. So one is, you know, why do we have morality as a species and more broadly? And then also, what do I think is what relevant and what are my moral foundations? Which the second one, I assume, is what you're asking.
I'm really asking about the second one, but the first one plays into it, because to some people think that's part of the reason why a morality can be good is because of how it evolved. I'm a little bit more neutral about that. I think that there's separate questions that do link. One is, how did we come to have this sort of morality and where did it come from, even from pre-human roots? And that correlates with the evolutionary advantage of ability to cooperate as social beings and so on. But at the same time, I don't think that just because something developed naturally means it's good in a sense of the way I think moral should be either. Yeah, so I'm mainly interested in the latter, but feel free to link
So, I guess for me, I have, as I said, I spent a long time trying to understand, you know, what was moral and whether or not there were moral truths. So, you know, being a moral realist or an anti-realist, and I've gone back and forth on that many times. And I want to put the caveat out there that I'm a psychologist, and so what I'm really qualified to talk about is what other people think, not what the fundamental truths are out there. I'm not a philosopher, but I don't know if I have a view that is in any inherent moral truths or not. I'm sometimes convinced that there are, and I'm sometimes convinced that they're not. But the thing that would come closest for me that I keep coming back to is this kind of idea of harm seems inherently bad. We want to be avoiding suffering, particularly if you really drill down into it. Harm that's committed in a non-consensual way, so harm without informed consent, seems like something that can fundamentally always be bad, though I'm sure there are philosophers out there who will disagree with me on that.
There are philosophers out there who will say all sorts of crazy things.
Exactly. And yeah, I think for me, it's really grounded in the idea that we want to reduce suffering. And when something has the capacity to suffer, it's something that it would be good to work to avoid or to prevent. And that's as simple as it's come down to for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, of course, is very linked to the sentientist ideology or perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's very similar to where I've got to, and I think you're right, that's almost the essence of sentientism, because it's suggesting that really all moral value is grounded in the experiences of sentient beings and the way that each sentient being evaluates those experiences, which is, in simple terms, the bad stuff is suffering and the good stuff is flourishing. And I find that whenever I talk to someone about a morally good or a bad outcome, and I say, well, try and describe a morally good or a bad outcome to me in a way that doesn't link to the experiences of a sentient being. And I haven't found anyone who's able to do it yet without using some sort of supernatural ethics. If you put that to one side and say, well, take a naturalistic ethics, whatever good and bad outcome people describe always seems to me to come back to its impact on the experience of a sentient being. It does almost seem like that is the grounding of a naturalistic ethic.
This is something that gets debated in the psychological community as well. So there's two big theories in moral psychology about moral judgments and what's moral. And one of them is moral foundations theory, which makes this argument that our moral judgments are made up of six different foundations. And then the other is this kind of model where, like, things that are immoral are harmful, and we can bring everything back to harm. And that really seems to be where I fall. And like, what I think, when you see variability in moral judgments, it's likely going to be variability in what we see as harmful. Yeah. So something that feels immoral to me but doesn't feel immoral to somebody else might be because I see harm being caused, whereas they don't. But then are you just replacing the word moral with harm? And what does that mean for the argument, right? Which I haven't resolved yet.
Yeah.
But I think part of my view also came from, you know, this realization. I have an quite existential tendency, so I often get into the place of being like, oh, nothing really matters in the true fundamental sense. And even in that case, if nothing really matters, then what I come back to is the experience of the beings on the planet that they have while they are alive, that matters to them. So even if nothing matters in the biggest sense, if there's a creature with interests and those interests are not being met, or they're suffering, then that seems like something that we should be working to resolve, even if it only matters to the individual at that time.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we're going to anger the YouTube gods, because we're going to struggle to argue about anything. We should be destroying each other about something. But I feel very much a similar way. The way you described the moral foundations is interesting as well, because when I look at the moral foundations, some of them I think they're important because of harm.
Yes.
And the ones that don't link to harm, I think are bullshit. So when you start talking about maybe sanctity, for example, if that relates to maybe a cleanliness or a hygiene thing that relates to harm, I can see some validity there. But if it's sanctity in the sense of, you know, reverence for a supernatural being that doesn't exist, I'm like, it has no foundation. So in a way, even, you know, as I look at the moral foundations, and I think they're a fascinating way, and I know there's different versions as well, I think they're a fascinating way of thinking about what we value and how people think. Ultimately, when you dig down, the ones that feel like they have resonance for me are because of that, and, you know, harm and benefit story. And it is odd, because it almost does feel tautological to me, but in a sense, tautologies are tautologies because they're right, right? So once you put a supernatural morality to one side, and a supernatural morality will often say, regardless of suffering and death and flourishing and life, those things in a sense are subservient. What really matters is obedience to the God or following these rules, right? So you go back to the story of Abraham, right? God said, kill your son. And the story is basically that would have been the right thing to do. And I find that deeply sickening and bizarre. So again, once you put that supernatural thinking to a side and you say, we'll have a naturalistic worldview, I'm not sure what morality is apart from having some concern with other beings. And if you're concerned for other beings, you're concerned for their perspective, and their perspective is their experience as a sentient being, which we describe the good stuff as flourishing and the bad stuff as suffering, and that's it. So I do get nervous about that sort of tautological element, but at the same time, that's almost what we've defined morality to be.
I think that's the view that I hold, and I think there's going to be arguments out there that vary from that, and people who would disagree, and I'm sure that they're, you know, have great arguments and they're very smart. But I guess from my perspective, for what I'm interested in doing and what I'm interested in my research being able to do, then that feels like a good place to, for me to start to then go out and say, okay, this is what I think. So what can I do to try and address these issues? And so I'm much more on the side of understanding what it is about human nature and our tendency to make different judgments and to deny moral status and all these kinds of things. And so I spent all of my teenage years debating those questions. And now I think, okay, what do I want to go on and try to do about it if this is what I've come to?
Yeah, we can move on now. And I think if someone says, okay, but why should we care about suffering? I think they're basically asking the question, why should we be moral? And you can ask that question, but in the sense that you described, there's no supernatural reason why we should be moral. But if we choose to be moral, we have to care about suffering and flourishing of other sentient beings. And hopefully, if people choose not to be moral, then the rest of us will constrain them. But ultimately, there's no perfect reason why we should be moral. But if you choose to be moral, which I hope you would, then this is what it is. And there, of course, there are also self-interested reasons why it's good to be moral as well. And that links to the other point you talked about before, which is about where did our morality come from and how did it evolve? And presumably, in an evolutionary sense, some form of rudimentary morality was useful to pre-humans, and that's where our morality came from, and it's still useful to us now. And that doesn't mean that evolutionary morality is by definition a good moral outcome, but it's laid the foundations that it's driven by the fact that, as you know, social beings that can reproduce and survive better when we collaborate, that collaboration has some value, and therefore on we go. And we're almost lucky enough to have developed a cognitive architecture that means we can then refine that and build on it and crystallize it and be more, even more consistent about it.
I think it's a very fortunate evolutionary trait that we've evolved to cooperate. But yeah, I guess the question of why should we be moral for me, it feels, of course we should be moral. But you're right. And it's not something that everybody agrees with, right? It's not everybody thinks, yes, we need to be out there making the world better. But I will say, I was talking to somebody about this today. I think that it feels to me anyway, like there has been a shift. And if we get away from the like broad, what is morality question, just even in terms of, you know, people seem to be more ethically motivated than they used to be. It's the fact that greenwashing even exists in companies is a sign that people do care about ethics and they do care about environmentalism and doing the right thing. And then you've got your questions of, do we only care about environmentalism because we're concerned about the state of the planet and our own children and all these kinds of questions, what's motivating it. But for me, it feels like there is increasingly a shift towards people caring about other beings and other creatures. And if you look at people's attitudes towards factory farming, generally aren't good. And I'm optimistic that there is a bit of a shift towards people being more ethically motivated than they used to.
Yeah, it certainly feels like that. And do you think that's because, is it a sort of classic Maslow's hierarchy thing, that as the world develops and people are less having to focus on the basic sort of security and existence needs, that they're freed up to think in a more ethically generous way? Or is that too simplistic?
I mean, the capacity to be moral and compassionate and care for others in a really tangible way where you can go out and help them is a huge privilege, right? To be able to be in that position, you have to have all of your needs met. And so I always try to remind myself of the fact that I'm incredibly lucky to be able to go out and try and do this research that I think might be able to help, because I'm in this really fortunate position.
Yeah, millions and billions of people aren't in that state. And your point about the moral realism, again, I don't want to drag you back to the sort of philosophical stuff, but again, I think we end up in a similar position, because I'm not a moral realist in a sort of platonic sense that I think moral truths are out there floating in the universe. Before sentient beings existed, I don't think there was any morality in that sense. But once sentient beings do exist, and once I can suffer and I know I don't like it, and I'm pretty confident you don't either, then in that sense, I'm a moral realist, because we exist as sentient beings in the physical universe. We have certain characteristics. Our information processing feels a certain way that we qualitatively value. So in a way, I don't think that technically is moral realism, but it's it's still grounded in a naturalistic understanding of reality.
So it's like a halfway point or something.
I think maybe that's it. Yeah, so it's not, I think the sort of relativist approach of almost anything goes, whatever you negotiate, is deeply insidious, because you can, if the wrong people have power in those negotiations, you can end up causing awful suffering.
Even if they're not malicious, suffering can be caused incidentally.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we described, we obviously a supernaturally based ethics, to my mind, can be somewhat arbitrary and potentially quite dangerous. Whereas I think this naturalistic grounding in the experiences of sentient beings feels more solid to me. But the other thing we've touched on, we've hinted at already, which is, I think many people would agree with that way of thinking, that suffering is bad, flourishing is good. It's hard to understand how people might disagree with that. But one of the critical things that I think most of philosophy seems to have moved on from, which I think is a real shame, is, okay, for which beings do we care about suffering and flourishing? So most moral philosophy is written as if it's only human beings that exist and only human beings that suffer. And again, you mentioned your family were already quite focused on animal ethics right from an early age. But was there a journey you went through about thinking about non-humans and expanding that moral scope?
Yeah, my journey actually went the opposite way than I think most people. So I, as I said, I was raised, I'm an only child, but I had lots of dog siblings. And we had birds. Mum was a wildlife carer, so I've been around animals my whole life. I've been caring for animals my whole life and always just really loved them. And I was raised vegetarian. And when I was probably about 15 or 16, I went through the whole, you know, getting really outraged about animal welfare and being vocal about it and stuff that I think I understand why people do it, but isn't always the most helpful approach to talking to people about animal rights and animal welfare. So I went through that. And then I went to university and I remember I took a course as an undergrad psych, looking at animal cognition and human cognition and what are the differences between humans and animal minds. And so if you're interested, there's a really great book called The Gap, written by Thomas Sudendorf, who was my lecturer. And it had such a big impact on me, that course. And at the start of the course, I remember going in thinking, oh, humans are so arrogant and we're just going to make the assumption that we're so much more intelligent than all these other creatures. And I'm sure that animals are just as intelligent as us or, you know, similarly intelligent to us. And I actually, like, through learning about the science, kind of dialed my perspectives back a little bit and I became a little bit more measured, where I think, yes, animals have the capacity to suffer and they easily meet that baseline of, you know, moral concern. But when you look at these higher order capacities, there are some things that humans have that animals don't. And I'm not, you know, fully informed on all of the latest science there, but my understanding is that, you know, a lot of our capacity for planning and thinking about the future and these kinds of things are quite unique. And so if anything, I actually went a little bit further backwards, but in terms of granting animals capacities, but much less so than would needed to then deny the moral status.
Yeah. And to me, that's the most important thing. I think there's all sorts of fascinating thinking about how to maybe grade moral value or to judge different capacities or to think about relational approaches that look at how different entities relate to each other. I think there's lots of value and lots of power in that. But the most important thing to me is, where do we set the scope of moral considerability? Because once something falls outside of that scope, it's basically anything goes, right? You can needlessly destroy it or cause harm to it without a moment's thought. Whereas once it's inside, needlessly causing suffering or death to it would be seen as morally negative. And it seems like it's almost that scope boundary that is the most important thing for me. And that's partly why, you know, the way I'm framing this view of sentientism remains neutral on all of that other philosophy. It says you could grade sentience, you could grade moral value in different ways, or you could have a more egalitarian approach. You could have a virtue ethics approach or a deontological approach or a utilitarian and consequentialist approach, whatever you like. But the baseline has to be all sentient beings are included in moral consideration. So that's the idea. So the idea is it's a really broad platform that leaves plenty of space for us to fight over all of the other things. But at least let's put our arms around all sentient beings in that context.
Do you think that there's just a simple yes or no, though?
No. Yeah, I personally do. So some other people who call themselves sentientists, and you'll see this in the animal advocacy movement as well, will take a more egalitarian approach where they'll say, look, who are we to judge the sentience of other animals? It might be technically simpler in terms of the information processing that they're doing, but maybe it has just the same qualitative valence to them or the same power to them. And maybe in some senses, humans, because we have more advanced capacities, might actually be able to mitigate our suffering in a way that a simpler animal can't. So people will make various arguments to say, maybe we should be more egalitarian about all sentient beings. Although, to be honest, I think even those people, when you put them through the thought experiment of you can only save a chicken or a human from a burning house, which will you go for? I think even there, their egalitarianism might break down. Personally, and I think I haven't really done a survey, but most people who call themselves sentientists will accord some sort of grading to sentience and will say, look, sentience, and this is my own personal view, seems to be a class of advanced information processing that has evolved, certainly in biological beings, as a way of modeling ourselves in an environment and modeling others. And in that context, because it's a class of information processing, it's breathtakingly rich and varied. And even within the human mind, the variety of sentient experiences is quite literally mind-bending. And so as you look across other species and potentially into even non-biological things, who knows what ranges of sentient experiences there are. So to my mind, it does make sense to almost follow the human intuition that there's more moral value in a human than there is in a chicken, and you can grade it roughly. But at the same time, because of the naturalistic commitment of sentientism, and we have to follow the science and take a naturalistic and a provisional view, there isn't a perfect answer either. So sentientism doesn't say, here's the list of species that are sentient. It just says, follow the science. And there's likely to be fuzzy boundaries and uncertainty, always looking for new evidence. And maybe we should be prudent and give the benefit of the doubt to some of the simpler entities where we're not sure. And so there's different sentientists will disagree over where the boundary of sentience is and how to assess it and how to grade it. But that's part of a naturalistic scientific worldview.
Yeah. While you were saying that, it occurred to me, I guess I'm not so sure that I think that the average person would disagree with you in theory. I think most people out there don't want to cause suffering. And what you get is inconsistencies, and as you were saying, in which creatures are worthy of, you know, being in this moral circle or being granted moral concern. And there's huge variability in what people think about that, and huge differences in different backgrounds and things like that. But I think a lot of people don't want to don't want to cause suffering. They would, if you gave them a no cost, you can stop suffering. I think most people would say yes. But what comes into it for a lot of people is either some kind of personal cost, you know, they don't want to give up eating meat because of the personal cost, or like a cognitive cost where the thought of these actions are quite unpleasant. And so it's easier to deny moral status. And so that's all of the research on cognitive dissonance in meat consumption is a good example of that, where are you familiar with Brock Bastian's work on this?
Yeah.
So people who think that they're going to be eating apple are less likely to deny moral status to animals than people who think they're going to be eating beef jerky. And it's just like this really classic experiment that shows how motivated we are to deny status. And so I don't necessarily think that people are out there not believing that animals should suffer or that they are worthy of some concern. It's just that there's all these other barriers in place that prevent us from acting or really committing to those kinds of views.
Yeah, I agree. And in a way, that's probably the focus of the final section of the conversation, which is you and I think we share a naturalistic worldview where provisionally and probabilistically we're trying to develop beliefs about the world by engaging with reality, remaining open-minded and having humility and being skeptical even of our own ability to really understand things. And we also have roughly a sentient-centric, whether it's a moral circle or a scope, we care about all types of suffering and all types of suffering beings. And I think you're right that although most of the 8 billion people on the planet still have a supernatural worldview, so they might disagree with us on that front. Even many people who are part of a religious worldview for most of their daily lives still really use a naturalistic approach. So there isn't an enormous gulf there. And on the sentiocentric side, I think you're right. While most of the 8 billion people on the planet still pay other people to harm and kill animals for their pleasure in a way that for most people isn't needed at all. So you might look at that and say, practically, therefore, they don't have a sentiocentric worldview. Actually, their ethics are sentiocentric, right? They wouldn't needlessly want to cause suffering to a sentient being that was in front of them, but there are all of these different blockers. We're in this weird situation where those blockers are standing between almost a latent, more compassionate ethic that I think many people do have, and the choices they take and the impacts they have. So in that context, that's where it would be fascinating to talk about some of the research you've done, because I guess the question is, what do we think a more compassionate, naturalistic future might look like? And how can we get there given those blockers and given the weirdness of human psychology and sociology?
Yeah. So I guess actually I want to put a caveat on what I just said before as well, which is what we were going over. While I think that, as you agreed with, I don't think that most people want to cause suffering, I do think there's still a view out there that humans are unique and superior. And so I'm not arguing that we don't think that. I think that's very true. And like some of the stuff that's come out of my recent paper looking at human and children and adult attitudes to animal lives has really made that quite salient for me lately. But it's more of the level of concern that we show for animals is not non-existent. It's just lower than maybe it should be given their capacities. And so I think it's more as a gradient rather than a concern is there or not. But for most people, I think it's still that humans are uniquely and differently more morally important than animals. And a lot of people seem to think of humans as, I guess it would be tied to religion, right? It's this idea that we are special and unique, and even though we know that we evolved from animals, we're not thought of in the same way. So human superiority.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because it's a question of how radically distinct are we as a species from all the others? And you're right, there's a religious way of getting to that where you say we are made in the image of God, and and we have souls and animals do not have souls, right? So there's a radical disconnect there, and we have dominion over them. That's not true in all religious contexts. Many religious people actually take the compassion of their religion and extend it way beyond the human species. Even within the Abrahamic religions, which aren't particularly good at it, many movements within the Abrahamic religions do that. But obviously when you go into Jainism and Buddhism and Hinduism and some of the other, and Rastafarianism particularly, they take a religiously motivated compassion and spread that much more broadly, albeit inconsistently. But there's also a naturalistic approach that can still have that sort of radical break as well. And it's more rare, but I was having a conversation yesterday with someone on Twitter who is absolutely convinced that non-human animals are incapable of suffering, absolutely convinced of it, because they think that without the capacity to plan for the future or without the ability to express things through language or have these higher cognitive capabilities, there is no capacity for suffering. And that's pretty rare. But even in a naturalistic worldview, we can still have this ability to have this sort of human supremacist view or the human exceptionalist view that sets us completely apart. But I think you're right. Most people, it's more subtle than that. It's more about how much moral consideration do we give to non-humans and what trade-offs are we willing to make against our own interests?
Yeah, and I'd be curious to hear about this person you're talking to, how they define suffering, because it sounds like a sort of higher order acknowledgement of suffering rather than can you be experiencing pain and want to get out of it. Something that I muse on all the time is if someone was going to be trapped in a room, a very unpleasant situation where you were being tortured or held against your will and physically suffering, but also potentially emotionally suffering, is it worse to be a human who has awareness of the greater world out there and therefore the comparison point, or is it worse to be an animal that doesn't understand and doesn't know that there's a greater world out there? And I really don't know what the answer is. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. And I go two ways, because on the one hand, as you say, maybe a human would have a wider conception of what we're missing out on, or we might feel because of our richer understanding of the agency of the person that's hurting us, that might cause us additional suffering because it's awful to feel the intent, negative intent of someone. And maybe a simpler animal wouldn't recognize those things. They wouldn't maybe know of the world outside and miss that potential. They might not have as rich a concept of their future life. They might not understand the agency of the person that's hurting them. Having said that, I think that the more we understand about non-humans, the more we appreciate that, you know, what I think you're right, that gap that you mentioned in the book is still important. The more we learn about them, the more they do seem to have an ability to plan and have richer social relations. And so we need to be careful always about just assuming they don't have these capacities. But I think sometimes, as you hinted at, it can work the other way around. As a human, we have the ability to understand context, right? We might know that we're going to be able to escape in the next couple of days. We might be able to meditate, to be able to mitigate our own suffering. We might be able to understand the context of why we're feeling the pain because there's some end we're going for. So I think it can work both ways. Sometimes you could imagine a situation where a non-human might be suffering more than us and vice versa.
What originally got me thinking about this was babies. When babies or really young children are upset, they can't imagine any other experience because they can't project into the future and know that they won't feel like that in 2 hours. And so not having those abilities could be quite distressing because of just the lack of anything else.
And of course, that's always an interesting place to go when people talk about non-human animals and say they can't suffer, or they can't suffer in a meaningful way. And then you have a conversation with them about babies or humans that have some form of cognitive impairments, and they back away from that perspective very quickly and talk about the baby will become a human that has
human has these capacities. Yeah,
exactly. And in simple terms, I think a baby, whether it has the ability to plan for the future or have a wider concept of the self or whatever, I don't care. It can suffer. It experiences suffering in a visceral, direct way that has moral valence. So needlessly causing a baby to suffer is a moral wrong, unless you have a really overridingly strong justification for doing so. And I think simply the same applies to non-human sentient animals as well. You need, even if it has only a basic capacity to viscerally experience suffering and pain, needlessly causing it to feel that pain is a moral negative, and we should therefore try not to do it.
Yeah, although I will add to that actually, and yeah, it's almost scary how much we agree on, but I have in recent years also updated towards the idea that, you know, there is... concerned. So I was a very angsty teenager and was definitely very much like, you know, humans are a plague on the planet and we really need to, you know, stop existing and all of this kind of stuff. And I've come around on that quite a lot because I think there's something to be said back that although animals, I think we're treating animals too poorly for their capacities, it does seem, as I begrudgingly came to agree with, that humans have greater capacities than animals in a lot of realms. And so while we shouldn't disregard animal sentience or animal capacity to suffer, the capacity for humans to be, you know, experience positive things or the potential for them to suffer does seem to be very important and is something that, you know, it would be a sad thing if that was gone from the world. And so there are ways in which I think we are granted a certain special status. And even I've heard Peter Singer say somewhat related arguments. So there's definitely arguments out there for humans as being special, but maybe just not as special as we think we are.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. Yeah. So in that context, how do you think about the future and how we can move towards a more compassionate future where there is less suffering, given these blockers and these sort of human psychological?
Yeah. So I think for me, probably the biggest principle that I have come to for this is that we need to stop asking people to do the hard moral work.
Mm.
So there's like lots of different ways that this comes out. But essentially, when you see a lot of activists or people advocating for animal rights or for different causes, people seem to come from the place where they really want people to make a moral change. And I would love if that was the case. I would love if we could get everybody to suddenly turn around and say, oh, we should be caring about the environment, we should be caring about animals, and therefore we should change our behavior. But it just consistently seems to be that we have our own priorities rated higher. And of course, you know, going back to this idea of your hierarchy of needs, it makes sense why we do that. So if you look at, for example, research on the reduction of meat, basically the biggest thing that influences what people buy in the supermarket is price, taste, and convenience. So ethical concerns come in, but only if these other three factors are met. And so what I think we need to do is move away from this idea of asking people to make moral change and instead facilitate them to make change for themselves or motivate the change for themselves. And I actually think, and I don't have empirical evidence to back this up yet, but this is a longer term thought that I've had, which is once people change their behavior, they might be able to change their attitudes. And so I almost feel like we need to flip the conversation around activism, stop talking about getting people to care and start getting people to change their behavior. And maybe, very big question mark, then they'll be able to start caring. And so I think this comes out in the context of meat. I remember being 16 and thinking, oh, there's no way the whole world's ever going to go vegetarian. What are we going to do? And then eventually coming onto this idea of cultured meat. And that's why I support it so much, because it allows people to continue doing what they love and eating meat, and they don't have to make change, but the suffering's gone. And yeah, so for me, I think that's might be, I guess, a little bit of a negative worldview with the idea that we can't expect people to make moral change, but what we want to do, right, is reduce suffering as efficiently and quickly as possible. And so I think that is really what needs to happen.
Yeah, and I agree. And it's very difficult from the activist or the animal advocate point of view, because we're almost deliberately having to take on our own form of moral dissonance to follow your advice. Because, and this is where the preachiness and the sometimes the aggression and the moral righteousness comes from, because just as with many social changes in the human world, we are so obviously right about the egregiousness of animal farming, for example, and the moral wrong that's being done is so awful and so clear and so direct that it's very natural to feel that righteous indignation and that sense of you must agree with me, right? In the same way as I can imagine as we feel when we talk about many problematic situations in human ethics as well, whether it's forms of discrimination or the history of various awful things that humans have done to each other. But at the same time, if what we really care about as an outcome is the reduction of suffering and death, we have to recognize the reality of human psychology and sociology. And that leads us to an approach that, yeah, is more about making it easy for people to do the right thing rather than hectoring them to, but it feels very difficult. It almost feels like we have to keep that righteous indignation somewhat hidden, and to be more polite and constructive and understanding and helping people find their way on a journey while inside many of us are tearing our hair out. It's strange.
So I think it's, no one likes to be told that they're wrong. And so if you come up to somebody and you say, oh, you're a terrible person, you should stop doing X, you should stop, you know, eating meat or any of these other things, then people are going to get defensive. And there's a lot of really interesting research on this. So I think in terms of science acceptability, there's some great work showing that the way that we can change people's minds about science and, you know, anti-science attitudes a potential model would be that either the information needs to come from a source that they already trust, or it needs to be something that they already agree with. And so if they already agree with it, element's gone. If you're trying to change somebody's mind, and so that information needs to come from a source that they trust, or it needs to come to them in a sort of accessible way that isn't going to have people become defensive. And so that is a focus on attitude change. And I think one thing that most people who are advocating for something don't really seem to be aware of is, if you're somebody who cares enough about an issue to be advocating, then you're already not representative of the typical population. And so the things that are motivating for you are not going to be motivating for other people.
And if you assume they are, you'll be ineffective.
Exactly. And animals might be the reason that you think people should give up meat, but research shows that a lot of people, most people, give up meat for health reasons. And so advocate from a health perspective. And you know, the research on this is really mixed. There's studies that point in lots of different ways. I think I recently read an overview arguing that health was the most motivating factor, but there are studies out there, for example, that show that people who go vegetarian for animal welfare reasons tend to stay vegetarian for longer. And so the research isn't totally clear, but I think as a base rule, you need to take the assumption that whatever is driving you isn't going to be driving the person that you're talking to. A colleague of mine, Tracy Schultz, has an amazing study where she looks at the use of disgusting images in pro-environmental campaigns, so a turtle with a plastic bag in the mouth, for example. And what she finds is that these kinds of disgusting images are only motivating for people who are already high in pro-environmental identity. For people who are low, it doesn't really have an impact, or it can have a negative impact. And so I think that's a great example of the fact that, of course, this is compelling for the people that are designing the flyers or designing the campaigns, but it's not compelling for the person they're talking to.
And that links to another concept, which is, it's very hard to condemn a system or a process or an activity if you're already part of it. You know, that links to exactly what you're saying. You become defensive and step away. And that's why, again, I think you're right. Your hypothesis that if you can help people change their actions first, that will free them up to improve their ethics. In some of these conversations, I've laid out what might be a naively optimistic view of childhood ethics, which comes onto some of your research, where I've suggested that maybe as a child, we start out quite naturalistic, right? Almost by definition, children don't believe in gods or other things, right? They're almost like mini scientists. They're exploring reality and building knowledge about it and are open-minded and developing knowledge. But then quite often we teach them supernatural stuff and religious ethics and so on. And in the same way, I've maybe naively suggested that children start out quite compassionate. If you introduce a child to a baby lamb or a pig, it won't kill it to eat it. So I've almost suggested they start out quite compassionate, but then we teach them that it's normal to consume sentient animals, and that we teach them the cognitive dissonance, and we teach them the distancing that enables them. But one of my guests, Diana Fleischman, recently, the evolutionary psychologist, suggested that maybe I'm being a little bit naive there, and that actually maybe young children often will experiment with non-human animals, right? Pulling the wings off flies, or they'll treat them as an object of interest. Maybe they're experimenting with them partly because predation and eating other living beings is quite a natural thing to do and has its own evolutionary past as well. Given your research, I'm really interested in your thoughts about whether I'm being too naive about this view of children having a really nice ethic that we then train them out of, that we're trying to get back to. Is that breathtakingly naive?
Yeah, no, maybe before my recent study, I would have thought yes. So my recent paper was looking at how basically we find that young children are weigh human and animal lives much more similarly than adults do when they're asked to make tragic trade-offs. And so adults will save one human over 100 animals, while children will save a human over 1.5 dogs or six pigs. Sorry, we'll say six pigs over one human or 1.5 dogs over one human.
Yeah.
And so essentially what this shows is that compared to adults, young children seem to just be much less speciesist. And I found that really surprising, to be honest. When we designed the study, we were trying to figure out what numbers were the right comparisons to include, and we did some piloting, and I was expecting we were going to have to go up to thousands and thousands of numbers to get children to be choosing to save the animal over the human. And we really didn't. We found even in the 1-2 case with dogs, they would quite often choose to save the two dogs over the one human. And so I was really surprised by this. And since we've been doing that research, there's been a few other studies from myself and some of my collaborators in Paul's lab, where we've been looking at children's tendency to ascribe moral status to others. And this is the dominant view in moral psychology, that young children start out selfish or self-oriented, and then they grow and become egalitarian over time. And so if you look at things like their tendency to share, young children share. As children get through to middle childhood, they start to share. If you look at things like in-group bias, that really peaks at around 4 or 5 years of age and then plateaus off across middle childhood. And so there is evidence to support these kinds of things. But what we're also starting to see is that young children seem to be much more willing than adults to grant moral status to a range of entities. And so I think from your perspective, that it does seem to align with your perspective. And so my take from our data has been, you know, potentially this suggests that our really strong speciesism approach to thinking about animals is something that we learn socially. But it might also indicate that as children get older and they learn about how we treat animals, they're motivated to then deny them status in a way that they're not when they're really young, because they're not aware of the horrors. And I think that some young children do seem to be aware of the meat comes from animals. I've asked five-year-olds, you know, where do chicken wings come from? Where does a steak come from? And they can tell me. But there's also a difference between knowing that meat comes from animals and really understanding the way that meat is produced. Yeah. And yeah, in terms of the comments about children experimenting with animals, I think that's potentially, I'm starting to think that what the distinction might be in these lines of research that shows that children can be really selfish or that children can be really quite egalitarian or have extensive moral circles might be the distinction between beliefs and behavior. So young children might have, you know, beliefs about what is right and moral, and I think they have quite strong beliefs and they don't seem to apply these differentially too much to humans and animals like adults do. But when it comes to behavior, it's really hard to override your inhibitions to want to take all the candy in that experiment. And so potentially that exploration comes into this like curiosity, even though that same child might say, oh no, it's morally wrong to, you know, pull the wings off a butterfly or to chop the head off an animal or something. But if that's something that they're curious about, maybe they just don't have the capacity to override the curiosity. And
yeah,
I'm increasingly coming around to the idea that you can hold conflicting moral views, and that doesn't mean that you don't genuinely believe them. So I might think that all children on earth are equally valuable and all are deserving to not suffer, but that doesn't mean that at the same time, I don't think of my own child as more important than other children, for example. And I think that you can genuinely believe both of those things. And so potentially the kids, they're genuinely believing these good things, but can't necessarily override their desire or their interest to explore or have all the candy.
That's fascinating. Thank you. And in a way, I think that brings us back to, you know, your preferred strategy to making the world a better place, which is, in one sense, the moral argument is too hard and too slow. But in another sense, we've already won the moral argument. I think most people already know, they already hold the belief that needlessly causing suffering to a sentient being is a moral negative. So in a way, it does come back to this idea of let's just make it easier for people not to do that, make it easier for them to change their behavior. And as you say, whether it's alternatives that are cheap and fast and available and socially acceptable, you know, if we can make that even more available, radically and quickly available than they are now.
And a norm that other people around them are eating.
Exactly. And more normalized. And that was one of the things that made my journey, which is always ongoing, slow, was I was almost deliberately not thinking about certain things because I knew if I did, it would lead me to become a, you know, weirdo vegan. Right. So, and it seems ridiculous to say, but it's massive. It is a massive factor, that social acceptability.
Well, I have a lot of conversations with people because when they hear that I do research on vegetarianism, people love to chat about their journey and all people that they know and things like that. And that's always a common theme I notice, that when people have somebody else in their life that goes vegetarian or vegan with them, or there's a social network around them, that seems to be when the shift really happens, even if it's something that they felt uncomfortable with for a while or felt uncertain about for a while. And so that is why I'm so interested in these, you know, young children who become vegetarian independent of their families, because they don't have that social network to do it. And so what's different about those people compared to the people, even though they made the choice, it took them a while or it took them the social support, whereas these kids seem to have this. And when we ask about their motivations, family vegetarians versus independent vegetarians are much more likely to cite moral reasons for not eating meat than family vegetarians. And that's consistent with past work by Paul Harris and Karen Hussar, who did the original work on independent vegetarians. And it seems to be really morally driven. And so it's interesting that some people need the moral undertone and the social driver, whereas some people just have the moral driver.
Yeah, yeah. And
Go ahead. I just wanted to qualify something I said before. So I don't think that we should completely dismiss the motivation for moral change. It's not that we should only care about practical things. I just think that the pendulum needs to swing a little more that way. We need to spend less time on the moral change and more time on the behavioral change. or more energy on the behavioral change book.
And that's an important point. I mean, it's one I agree with as well. And it feeds into this battle within the animal advocacy movement around a sort of welfarist approach versus a more abolitionist approach. And, you know, I don't have a settled view on it, but my sense is that following a more incremental approach is probably going to deliver better outcomes. But we need to maintain our eyes on the prize, which is an abolitionist end. And there is a danger that if the greenwashing and the ethics washing and the humane washing is successful enough, then you provide people with a place they can stop on this journey that is still causing catastrophic suffering and death. And that's, I think that's partly why some people are nervous about the sort of more incremental welfarist or even the incremental journey in terms of meatless Mondays and veganuary. It's not enough. It's great you're on a journey, but don't stop.
Yeah. And I think this is also, it's relevant outside of animal welfare as well, right? If we think about the potential far future capacity for artificial sentience and for the suffering of, you know, people that are still alive today and like people that are alive today that are human as well. There's all of this continuing to exist suffering, and I can understand the concern if we don't push really hard, we're not going to get there. But I think most of, maybe that's too strong a claim, I think that there is good evidence that the abolitionist approach in a lot of cases doesn't convince the masses.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe it just takes longer, but if however many billion animals are killed every day from factory farming, anything we do that continues this kind of these practices for even a day is an increase in billions of animals, an increase in suffering for billions of animals. And so it feels like really pressing to try and get things done now while there is this much suffering in so many avenues.
Yeah, I agree. Now, we've been running for quite a while, so are you all right to go a little bit longer?
Yeah, no worries.
Because there's one other piece of your research that I really wanted to focus on as well. If we're thinking about providing cheap, available, tasty alternatives, again, in the animal, non-human animal sphere, clearly a bunch of those are already out there and are developing, particularly in certain economies and cultures, very quickly, and in many cases have been around for thousands of years, right? So there's obviously plants, which apparently are quite a good idea, but obviously plant-based alternatives and increasingly realistic substitutes for some of the animal-based products that people are interested in. But of course the next stage and potentially a supplement to that is the clean meat or cultured meat products as well, which technically and chemically are actually meat products or animal products. You know, they'll almost be indistinguishable and arguably engineered to be better. But there's some risks around the adoption of those as well, which again come back to some of our weird human psychology. It'd be interesting to what's your perspective on the likely adoption of those and some of the blockers that we've got to watch out for as we.
Yeah. So I feel like I talk to a lot of people in the cultured meat industry who have the view that once things are priced similarly and they're convenient and they taste as good, everybody will adopt them. And I know this is what research says, that these are the biggest factors. And I think that, you know, they're absolutely necessary, but I'm also concerned if you look at something like the rejection of genetically modified food. So golden rice is a great example. Golden rice has this carotene in it, which allows you to absorb vitamin A. And this is vitamin A deficiency is a huge problem. There's, I think it was obscenely high numbers of millions of people each year die or go blind from vitamin A deficiency around the world.
It's incredible. And
there are charities out there working to get people vitamin for this, because then you don't need the charities out there delivering vitamins. You just have the rice. And so to me, it seems, of course, this is something that we should be supporting, but there's a lot of opposition because it's genetically modified. And there's a lot of research out there, and genetically modified food is incredibly controversial, but it seems to me that there's good evidence that they're typically, overall, they're safe and they're not bad for the environment. And maybe I'm biased here because this is my own view. And so, of course, I'm going to pay more attention to the evidence out there that supports my own view. But it seems there's good arguments to be developing genetically modified food for environmental reasons, for global health reasons, for ethical reasons, but people reject it. And I worry that in the terms of cell-based meat or cultured meat or cultivated meat, I think is the new term, that people may reject for similar reasons. So concerns about health and safety, concerns about naturalness in particular is something that I'm quite interested in, this idea that natural is good and unnatural is bad. And I think of it almost as a natural is good heuristic, like a shortcut that we use to make judgments about things. If it's unnatural, then it's bad. And also just, we're not particularly good as a species at updating our beliefs with evidence. And I think there's, you know, people out there that try to address this, and like the effective altruism community, which has had quite a big impact on my thinking. It's all about updating your beliefs and using evidence. But many people are not motivated by this. They're motivated by their feelings, and they're motivated by what's familiar and what feels good and what feels bad, and avoiding what feels bad. And so I worry that these kinds of concerns might end up being a barrier to the adoption of cultured meat. And I don't necessarily think it would stop it, but as I was saying, if you even slow this adoption of this kind of stuff down, you're prolonging suffering. And so I hope that it gets taken seriously by the people that are producing it and marketing and selling it. And some of my own research does touch on our tendency or potential to reject cultured meat for a range of reasons, most notably, which is the view that it's unnatural.
Yeah. And that sort of natural label and heuristic is deeply bizarre given how it's applied as well.
Yeah. And it's just so, I still find it so confusing. I was having a meeting with somebody about it this morning and I still can't get my head around like what it is that we think is good about natural.
Yeah. Yeah. And the things we class as natural. I'm living in a house, we're talking on the internet, you know, but these aren't morally objectionable, but factory farming is a natural thing. Apparently.
Well, in a recent study, I found that like naturalness and acceptability are really highly correlated, right? So the more natural you think something is, the more acceptable you think it is, and vice versa. And I'm not making any causal claims there, but just that there's a relationship between these things. And it's interesting though, even though I have this sort of almost now a vendetta against the term natural, because especially in marketing, it doesn't mean anything. So if you look at a lot of regulations around what can and can't be called natural. There's no, it's not like organic where you have to have a certain certification. Natural really can mean nothing. But sometimes I'll pick up a bottle of shampoo in the supermarket and go, oh, look, this natural new shampoo. Yeah. And then I catch myself and I'm like, what are you doing? You know better than this.
Chemical,
so I'm certainly subject to
natural and chemical free.
Yeah.
There are no chemicals in this. Really? Okay.
I think there's chemicals in everything. Yeah, so yes, there's this kind of, view that natural seems to be good. And there's a lot of really amazing research out there. So Paul Rosen has pioneered a lot of this work looking at the characteristics of what makes things natural versus unnatural. So process is considered more heavily than content. So I have, for example, two glasses of orange juice and I add chemicals to one and then I use a special machine and remove the chemicals and I don't touch the other one, even though they're now molecularly identical because the chemicals have been removed. The one that had the chemicals in it is less natural. So we prioritize the process and the history of the object over its current form when we're making these judgments.
Yeah.
But something that I have been trying to understand and I haven't found a lot of research on is, what is it that actually drives us to call something unnatural? And my collaborators and I have been mostly looking at this in the context of cultured meat, but we've also been looking at the developmental origins of naturalness. So I've just finished a paper where we look at how, whether or not young children use the term natural in a similar way to adults. And I'm hoping to do a text analysis to look at how natural the term has been used across history and try and look cross-culturally as well to give me a starting point to work from with understanding this. But I'm increasingly convinced by the idea that it's an emotional drive. So it's not that we think, okay, here's a thing and I've evaluated it rationally and I've decided it's unnatural. But if anything, it's here's something that I've had a negative emotional response to for some reason. And so my response, because I've been told that it's safe or I've been told that it's molecularly identical, but it still feels bad and unnatural is something that I can say that isn't really easily disputed. And so we have a little bit of indirect evidence in our most recent paper to support this. But what I'd like to be able to do in the future is induce people to feel things like disgust or fear and see if that increases their tendency to call things unnatural as a way to investigate this going forward. And then I think something that I find compelling in an argument for this, and you can tell me if you're convinced by it, is I think that the kinds of things that we spontaneously would call unnatural is quite different than the kinds of things that we would claim would be unnatural if we were asked to make, if we were given a list of things and were said, is this natural or is not? So for example, like reading glasses, or as you were saying, the computer, all of these things are technically unnatural, but we would never call them unnatural. And I think it's because when we call something unnatural spontaneously, it's to indicate that it's bad and it's to indicate a negative emotion. And so
it's a label we apply after the fact, not a rationale. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Almost when I first started thinking about this, I thought about it from the moral dumbfounding perspective of that we call something immoral, even though we can't identify where the harm is. And in the same way, you can't identify what the negative is, but you just call it unnatural. And I think that's a good example of the fact that we're humans and we're not always rational and you can't expect people to be able, just because they might know something's right or they might know that they agree with something, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be able to act on it. And if people have these really negative emotions, it's difficult to overcome and some people aren't motivated to overcome them.
Yeah, yeah. No, that resonates strongly. And that's partly why in this sort of recasting of sentientism, I've been so keen to include a naturalistic worldview in it, because, and that's a naturalistic worldview as distinct from the you know, the yes. naturalistic fallacy. This is naturalism as in using evidence and reason to understand the reality as, I guess, a scientific worldview. And that's partly because I think just a sentiocentric moral compassion isn't good enough. Because if you care about all sentient beings, but you don't have a naturalistic worldview, there's a number of risks. One is you might believe in something that's more important than all of those sentient beings, which might be a god or a one-party state or something else that justified you causing enormous suffering to sentient beings, even though you care about them, because there's something that's even more important, or there's some rule that's overridden it or told you that causing suffering is a moral thing to do. And I don't think you can find that within a naturalistic worldview, partly because without a naturalistic worldview, you're more likely to make mistakes about assessing which entities are sentient, right? So if you don't take a naturalistic worldview, you might think that humans are the only ones that are capable of suffering because you haven't looked at the science that demonstrates mm-hmm. that most non-human animals are as well. But finally, without a naturalistic worldview, I think you're also just going to be much less effective. So in the situation you've outlined, right, if you a non-naturalistic approach leads you to reject cultured meat or GMOs or some other sort of technical innovation that just rationally is really going to do some good, but you reject it for non-naturalistic reasons, then we're missing out on opportunities or maybe causing needless harm, even though we have a generous sentiocentric compassion. Does that make sense? So that's partly why I'm saying sentiocentrism isn't enough. You need sentiocentrism and a naturalistic worldview. And then hopefully that's a solid foundation for making the world a better place. So.
Yeah, I think that could be quite convincing.
Yeah, hopefully so. It seems to resonate with some people. So 7.997 billion people to convince so far. We have about 300 people on our I'm a sentientist wall so far. So we have a way to go, maybe. But given that work and the fact that you've done some fascinating research into human psychology, as a closing question maybe, how optimistic do you feel about our ability to drive positive change? And that's not just in the non-human animal sphere, that's also yeah. in some of the human ethics you've talked about, and even potentially beyond human sentience.
Yeah, I'm always it varies day to day, right? Some days yeah. I'm really hopeful, I'm really optimistic, and I think that we can do it, and I think eventually we will get there. It's just a matter of, you know, how long is it going to be in the next 50 to 100 years, or is it going to be in 2000 years, and then you've got all these potential existential risks to come and get in the way of, you know, our continuing existence and our planet. So I think we will get there one day, but yeah, it really varies day to day on how soon I think we will get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So apologies, I know it's somewhat of a non-committal answer. But
no, it's entirely fair, and it's good to be non-committal when we're not sure. And as we talked about, I think I'd agree that humans have some pretty distinctive, amazing capabilities, and along with those capabilities come responsibilities as well. However egalitarian we might want to be across the species, I don't think there's another species that's going to fix the problems we've caused, so we better take responsibility for doing it. And absolutely central to that has to be a good scientific understanding of the vagaries and weirdness of our own minds, because without understanding that, we're in real trouble. So your work is absolutely central to that, and deeply fascinating. So thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to all of the future papers you mentioned as well.
Fingers crossed if they get out there.
So before we finish up, what's the best way of people following you, learning more about your work, reading your papers? I can include links in the show notes as well to your website and accounts.
Yeah, I have links to most of my papers, I think, on my website. I'm not sure that all of them are open access, but if people like my email's on my website as well. So you're very welcome to email me if you would like to read any of the papers. And also my most active academic online presence is Twitter. So I'm just at @Maddie_Wilkes on Twitter.
That's great. I will include the links. Well, it's been an inspiration to talk to you. Thank you so much for spending so much time with me, and thank you for your deeply important work. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?